Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Enlightenment, An Idea and Its History, by J.C.D. Clarke. Read by Mike Cooper. Sir Thomas More. His discourse was extraordinary facetious. Riding one night, upon the sudden, he crossed himself, majore cruci, crying out, Jesu Maria, do you not see that prodigious dragon in the sky? They all looked up, and one did not see it, and nor t'other did not see it. At length one had spied it, and at last all had spied, whereas there was no such phantom, only he imposed on their fantasies. Aubrey's Brief Lives, edited by Oliver Lawson, Dick, London, 1949, page 214. Preface. The Enlightenment is a term now relied on and widely accepted, both across popular culture and in a variety of academic disciplines, including history, philosophy, political theory, political science, literary studies, and theology. Such disciplines often reveal their shared premises, that it was, in the 18th century, an immensely important international phenomenon, a thing, that it can therefore be located within, even that it identified a chronological period, that, as such, it was crucial, for good or ill, in a transition to modernity. The present book provides evidence for a very different conclusion, that the Enlightenment was instead a concept that, with its current meanings, was unknown in the 18th century, that far from being a phenomenon, it was an idea, an explanatory category, that the only history to be written is therefore the history of the concept and its uses, and that the invention and proliferation of this concept constitute an importantly different story from that which is conventionally assumed, notably that modernity too was a concept rather than a phenomenon. In the 20th century, the historiographical concept with the most profound general consequences was the Industrial Revolution. Today, that position is held by the Enlightenment. It is used in many societies as a framework for, or an abridgment of, what has been called their civil religion, that is, the beliefs, symbols, and rituals that register a secularized understanding of their origins, ideals, rhetorics, and aims, an understanding that once coexisted with, but that has largely succeeded, Christianity. The contention that the Enlightenment was not an early and precocious thing, but a much later idea, therefore has consequences for those civil religions. This book does not engage in a wrangle about words. Instead, it contends that arguments over the nature of the Enlightenment have hitherto been based on a false premise, and it offers a historiographical alternative. In the absence of such a revision, the subject has been vulnerable to the ascription to it of a bewildering variety of meanings. It has, therefore, been the site of controversies that proved impossible to resolve. Recently, one famous contest in particular has commanded attention. Modernist images of the Enlightenment, celebrating its championing of reason, cosmopolitanism, democracy, toleration, and economic growth as components of a secular idea of progress, are still among the most powerful assumptions within the wider culture. Meanwhile, academic postmodernists frame negative critiques of that modernist model by attributing to the Enlightenment, which they also need to assume was a phenomenon, the rationalism that they contend led to totalitarianism, imperialism, racism, scientism, and sexism. In other words, to the hegemonic values of the West. The literature making use of these schools' interpretations for presentist purposes is large, and has grown on library shelves to the point where alternatives are difficult to find. The claims of that literature to moral authority still receive heartfelt reassertions. The Enlightenment may even be the key ground on which the contest between modernists and postmodernists is fought, and much depends on the outcome of the questions explored here. In 1982, at an early stage of that contest, Jean-François Lyotard wrote of that severe re-examination which post-modernity imposes on the thought of the Enlightenment, on the idea of a unitary end of history and of a subject. But the notion of the Enlightenment was developed before this binary alternative between modernism and postmodernism was framed, and more issues are examined in this book. Some may argue that the concept has lately been emptied of content and is now left only as a label for a chronological period, but this book offers evidence that the alleged contents are still fought over in many countries. The latest defensive strategy has been to extend the initially European Enlightenment into a global presence, but increasingly evident global diversities make a unified phenomenon less rather than more plausible. Accounts of the Enlightenment imagined as a phenomenon therefore differ greatly, even among modernists and even over such basic matters as the dating and geographical location of their subject. The present book contends that these disagreements cannot be fused into any single story, whether of progress in the minds of modernists or of regress in the minds of postmodernists. Rather, the disagreements are themselves the story. If what constitutes the Enlightenment is now a puzzle, what is the solution? Here I resolve the current impasse by historicizing the concept, and when, in these chapters, I use this term to denote that concept, the Enlightenment appears within inverted commas. Without the inverted commas, the term signifies the still widespread assumption of the existence in the past of a phenomenon, the reality of which is mistakenly assumed to have been independent of its label. If the consequences of the idea were highly diverse, its origins were less so. In current academic discourse, the Enlightenment tends to be constructed as either a historical or a philosophical phenomenon. This book may even make problematic the familiar binary distinction between modernists and postmodernists. The valid distinction may instead be between historians, who should be able to test the supposed stadial transition on which this binary alternative depends, and philosophers, who often employ historical concepts taken on trust. Modernists and postmodernists equally expect to be accepted on their own estimations. Here, I seek to historicize both. There are, then, competing versions of what modernists, postmodernists, and others still assume was an undeniable phenomenon, but seen from a vantage point far from urban academe and free from its insistent groupthink, the premises embodied in each competing version look less self-evident. I wrote this book while looking out over a different landscape. In 1946, introducing a work of unusual chronological and geographic range, Fernand Braudel expressed the hope that it will perhaps prove that history can do more than study walled gardens. Here, I hope to draw inspiration from the legacy of Capability Brown. Perhaps the owners of La Brède and Fermi enjoyed similar vistas. This book might have been titled The View from Somewhere. Wider horizons revealed that the Enlightenment, understood as a phenomenon, and even if diversified into the plural, is arousing doubts among some historians, even while it continues to proliferate in the popular discourses of their host societies. For those who express unease at such problems, I offer responses to their concerns. It would be encouraging if this book proves to be a timely contribution to a number of reconsiderations currently underway. Meanwhile, the old orthodoxies are still mostly in place. Indeed, they have recently been reasserted. To promote its ends as a history, this book takes no part in normative disputes on the merits or demerits of the Enlightenment or of an allegedly related phenomenon, modernity. It seeks neither to bury the Enlightenment nor to praise it. It is written neither to denigrate nor to vindicate any existing interpretation of any such movement. I am not enlisted in the ranks of any Enlightenment or of any counter-Enlightenment. I am not a Neo-Lockean, not a Neo-Kantian, not a Neo-Spinozist. I was never a modernist, and so had no need to become a postmodernist. I make no claims to superhuman omniscience or objectivity, but my vantage point is my own. Recent scholarship is fraught with controversies between adherents of one or other Enlightenment school, but these contests are fought over a gulf profound as that Sabonian bog, betwixt Damiata and Mount Cassius old, where armies whole have sung. I prefer not to join these misconceived battles on such treacherous territory, and seek, where possible, to present my own evidence and to frame my own interpretations. The Enlightenment is a problem not least because of its normative implications. Historians who contend that universal values or self-evident truths can instead be explained historically often meet with resistance from those values' true believers. Readers have found it hard not to endorse one or other vision of human emancipation and fulfillment. Each has its passionate advocates, who conscript often unwilling friends, and its embittered opponents, who provoke often unwilling enemies. Here I am neither. And except in quoting from original sources, I've avoided those insidious words we, us, and our, which covertly imply the wide acceptance of an author's merely personal commitments. The task of historians is to explain manifest disagreement, not to celebrate some non-existent unanimity. Instead, this book has given me the opportunity of engaging with a remarkable array of thinkers of earlier centuries. I've greatly enjoyed their company. I have admired the skill of the skaters as I watched them on bright mornings demonstrate their past mastery on the shining surface of my inviting lakes. My enjoyment was only qualified by a growing apprehension of how many of them were in danger of falling through the ice. My preference would have been to discuss these individuals' ideas and their context rather than their later historians, but this book's chronological scope compels me to ask questions of all three. By taking the story to the present, I'm obliged to consider present-day authors also. None is here criticised. Instead, I pay my colleagues the compliment of seeking to understand them historically. If any historian is reproved in this book, it is myself alone, for formally failing to see the wood for the trees and for taking so long to find a way out of a conceptual maze. As an undergraduate, I was confronted by an alarming array of fierce heraldic beasts, the reified concepts of late modernism, but trust that I have clipped them at last into elegant topiaries. In respect of method, it is fashionable to demand that 1,000 flowers should bloom. Within my own borders are cultivated just 6 such plants: textual readings, contextual studies, discourse analysis, the social history of ideas, the history of concepts, and counterfactual analysis. Some of them intertwine to form histories of historiography, and these now create context. They prove to be diverse, for any human activity can constitute an intellectual context, not just the authorship of the leather-bound volumes that surround me in my library. My initial intention was that this book would be a social history of ideas, but older studies normally focused on major authors, often termed philosophers, and pursuing the history of historiography has, in places, necessarily drawn the argument back to a close reading of their texts. Such sections are not to be understood as a pre-commitment to the assumption that principle always preceded practice. This is a matter for research. Whatever my chosen methods, this book, more than any, has only impressed on its author a keen sense of his ignorance of those great expanses of meadow and field, the as-yet-unharvested acres of evidence that stretch away beyond the walls of the categories discussed here to a distant horizon, and that will, I anticipate, amply reward the labours of future students. For their researches, I have every good wish. The philosopher John Locke, in a book often later held to be the starting point of the English Enlightenment, memorably defined his own ambition as that of being employed as an under-labourer in clearing the ground a little and removing some of the rubbish that lies in the way to knowledge. This image might be resented by authors who have built their histories on the assumption of the Enlightenment as a phenomenon, and a historiographical response is needed. This book is the result. Here I have tried to follow the ideal of England's pioneering historian of philosophy, that there is due to everyone the commendation of their own deserts. And as always, I appeal to an innocent teaching. The chief aim of the historian is the elucidation of the unlikenesses between past and present. Killaly Castle, Northumberland, August 2023. Introduction. Why is the Enlightenment a problem? In the English-speaking world during the long 18th century, enlightenment was everywhere, but the Enlightenment was nowhere. The terms are not synonyms, since enlightenment was later appropriated, reified, that is, turned into a thing, and given a leading capital as a name grouping together projects that had seldom been present in the 18th century, and few of which were then thought to cohere in a common cause. This is a book about how, when, and why talk of the Enlightenment emerged. In the age of modernism, the answers given to these 3 basic historical questions often tended to be easily, earlier than you thought, and as appropriate expressions of underlying realities. Today, historians' conclusions are more often the opposite. This study asks why the discourse of the Enlightenment did not evolve early or naturally out of Enlightenment, and what the consequences of that belated development eventually were. Because the Enlightenment was not an 18th-century locution, this book shows how a history of the Enlightenment can only be a history of the uses to which that term was put in later decades. The History of Ideas and Its Discontents. Since the Enlightenment is already evoking doubts, it would be easy to argue instead that the notion was merely what the philosopher Gilbert Ryle called a category mistake, or alternatively a translation error, and that it must now be deleted. Easy, but historically insufficient. This book attempts to frame a more nuanced argument, but a historically appropriate one, that the rhetoric which came to celebrate a unitary enlightenment in Western Europe and North America was overstated, that values and practices within and between those societies over time displayed some commonalities, but more differences, That the emergence of the concept and the idea of a movement which that concept appropriately labelled was much later than was even recently assumed. That in the century in which the Enlightenment is usually located, there was not one interesting and important thing happening, but many. The interest and the importance of those many things are affirmed in this book, even while the overarching concept so often retrospectively applied to deploy them for later purposes is analysed historically. Instead, this book contends that the Enlightenment was not a precocious and international reality, but a recent term of historiographical art, that, despite appearances, it lacked, in most European languages, early synonyms, that it was a term hardly used in the English-speaking world before the mid-20th century, but then and later projected back onto the 18th for presentist purposes. Since the term lacked an 18th-century referent, it could be, and has been, made to mean whatever later writers wished, a meaning established not least by those writers' choices of its putative participants. These uses are to be explained historically, not judged for their virtue. This book's aim, as its deliberately chosen subtitle reveals, is not to announce that the Enlightenment was this or the Enlightenment was that, but to trace the historical trajectory of some of the differing variants of the Enlightenment. When, how, and why they were coined, propagated, achieved currency, and began their decline. What historiographical methods have yielded these conclusions? Diverse but related, they have been powerfully expounded, successfully applied, and are now widely acknowledged. Three classic opening statements should be recalled, not to exhaust the rich and important debates on method and substance that stem from them, but instead to illuminate the present book's signposts to its directions of travel. None of these three foundational statements explicitly addressed the Enlightenment, which rose to its present prominence only later, but they were formulated without the influence of normative conflicts over that concept. First, John Pocock. He warned of the historian's conventional and traditional need to give as completely rational an explanation as possible of the piece of thought with which he is concerned. The level he chooses will therefore tend to be high and to rise. He selects the assumptions on the basis of which the piece of thought can be explained with maximum rational coherence, and then seeks to show that they were in use at the relevant period and were employed by the thinker or thinkers he is studying. Hence, the history of political thought has a constant tendency to become philosophy. This book does not presume any maximum rational coherence necessarily embodied in the Enlightenment, nor presume that its assumptions were in use in the 18th century and has sought to historicise even recent philosophers. After study that led him to focus on the languages of politics, Pocock added, in summary, "Men cannot do what they have no means of saying they have done, and what they do must in part be what they can say and conceive that it is." So this book is about a number of explicitly expressed reforms or campaigns, and offers doubts about how far what their proponents said and did can be understood as part of any movement that was conceptualised only long after their lifetimes. Disowning grand reifications, John Donne warned against one variety of the history of ideas that was written as a saga in which all the great deeds are done by entities which could not, in principle, do anything. In it, science is always wrestling with theology, empiricism with rationalism, monism with dualism, evolution with the great chain of being, artifice with nature, politic with political moralism. Its protagonists are never humans, but only reified abstractions. Because of these features, it is often extremely unclear whether the history of ideas is the history of anything which ever did actually exist in the past. In the present book, the Enlightenment does no deeds, great or otherwise. It does not wrestle with the counter-Enlightenment, or with absolutism, or with l'infâme, or with superstition, or with prejudice, or with tradition. It does not articulate reason or toleration. It is not a personified actor on the world, or even just the European stage. It does not think. It does not speak. It does not become self-aware. It does not act. Dispensing with such reified abstractions, Quentin Skinner identified what validly remained the subject to be explained. As soon as we see that there is no determinate idea to which various writers contributed, but only a variety of statements made by a variety of different agents with a variety of different intentions, what we are seeing is that there is no history of the idea to be written. There is only a history of its various uses and of the varying intentions with which it was used. The only histories of ideas to be written are histories of their uses in argument. This book is about the uses in argument that people made or did not make of the idea of the Enlightenment and their intentions in so doing. It contends that claims to reveal the essence or core of any such determinate idea are themselves to be analysed historically, not accepted at face value. To achieve its ends as a history, this book does not confuse metaphors with realities, it does not deal with disembodied entities or reified abstractions or ideal types or anthropomorphism. It is not about processes or inevitabilities or underlying causes or self-evident truths. It is about individual people, their ideas, and their contexts. So its chapters, like those on liberalism and on socialism, offer a gallery of individual thinkers rather than accounts of disembodied entities. Historians may register their discontent that these opening arguments have seldom yet been adopted into Enlightenment studies. The present book attempts explanations of their occlusion and shows the results of now deploying them. There are important consequences for other adjacent disciplines. If historiography shows that there are no determinate ideas creating what are termed perennial problems in philosophy or political science, it is clear that the Enlightenment cannot have been an attempted answer to an obvious selection of those problems. This book's purpose is not to dispense with all explanatory concepts, but to historicize some of them that have been put to anachronistic polemical uses in recent decades. At least this approach establishes why the Enlightenment cannot be blamed for any of a range of 19th or 20th century evils sometimes attributed to it. Such attributions are themselves to be explained. This method also allows the present book to offer an alternative in the recent and extensive debate over whether there was, in the 18th century, one Enlightenment or several Enlightenments. It answers neither, and answers also that the Enlightenment cannot be claimed as the intellectual property of any one country or philosophical school. It is, at present, common for writers to profess to be conceding the diversities and even the contradictions of the Enlightenment, while in the next paragraph writing of the Enlightenment as a unity. It is suggested here that this locution reveals only a confusion of method. Similarly, it is now evident that the Enlightenment and modernity have often been conventionally defined in terms of each other, especially in relation to a thesis of secularization. This argument's circularity reveals the problematic status of both. Although the Enlightenment has often been presented as the ideological program of modernity, the set of ideas and values from which modern, democratic, and secularized Western societies have emerged, this scenario encounters problems in the light of scholarship that reveals the geographical, thematic, and ideological diversity of the Enlightenment and of its putative members. It is also the case that the Enlightenment cannot be presented as one of the cornerstones of modernity if modernity too is a recent explanatory concept, not a historical phenomenon. The old model of modernity and the supposed process of modernization were often premised on a historiography claiming to explain the general development of English, then British society, from the late 17th to the early 19th centuries, especially in respect of political change, secularization, and economic development. That period and that geographical territory were of central importance, although the interpretive model built on them was later extended geographically. Yet these scenarios have, since the 1980s, met with growing challenges. From being unquestioningly accepted as processes, they are increasingly seen as ideologies, employed to reorganize the long 18th century for later purposes, and as ideologies dependent on concepts retrospectively devised and imposed on a past that was innocent of them. Modernism was eventually opposed by authors often identified with a movement now termed postmodernism. The term postmodern can be traced to the late 19th century, but as yet used occasionally and only in restricted circles. In the 1960s and 1970s, it was adopted much more widely by philosophers, historians, and others. Both modernism and postmodernism took several forms, and so were resistant to definition. They are explored here only with reference to the concept that is the subject of the present book. Since this is not a history of postmodernism, two individuals must stand for many. The philosopher Jean-François Lyotard, 1924-88, was an early framer who gave the notion wide currency, but in 1979 he recorded that the word is in current use on the American continent among sociologists and critics. It designates the state of our culture following the transformations which, since the end of the 19th century, have altered the game rules for science, literature, and the arts. Even at this early stage, postmodernism was a construct whose authors relied on premises both philosophical and historical, and its principles were heavily influenced by prior practice in the United States. Indeed, these premises were linked. As Lyotard observed, the postmodern is undoubtedly a part of the modern. Our working hypothesis is that societies enter what is known as the post-industrial age, and cultures enter what is known as the postmodern age. Lyotard thus implicitly relied on a scenario of economic change that had been worked out by modernist historians. What was different, in his account, was that postmodernism offered a critique of the discourse of legitimation, this discourse being a grand narrative that was, in its most general form, the Enlightenment narrative. But the Enlightenment was not dissected in his pages. Rather, he wrote, "Simplifying to the extreme, I define postmodern as incredulity toward meta-narratives." Equally, to simplify, it may be suggested that Lyotard offered a philosophical alternative, language games that yielded only a heterogeneity of elements. Postmodernist philosophy, then, adopted key concepts from modernist history, and those concepts can now be shown to be problematic. Meanwhile, the contest had a political dimension. Lyotard was clear at an early stage about the territory on which this contest was fought. "I have read a thinker of repute who defends modernity against those he calls the neoconservatives. Under the banner of postmodernism, the latter would like, he believes, to get rid of the uncompleted project of modernism, that of the Enlightenment." The Enlightenment became a territory of conflict for modernists and postmodernists alike. Their conflict raised issues that were important more widely than these two schools and will perhaps survive them. Many readers currently approach this contest through a famous essay, "What is Enlightenment?" by a philosopher of the same generation as Lyotard, often in his later years identified as a postmodernist, Michel Foucault, 1926-84. Foucault argued that in Kant's essay, "Was ist Aufklärung?", we may recognize a point of departure, the outline of what one might call the attitude of modernity, modernity being a permanent critique of our historical era. Yet Foucault sought to redefine this critique in subjective terms of aesthetic self-fashioning in order to validate an ethos facilitating a possible transgression, not defined, against arbitrary constraints, again not defined. By such an achievable transgression, modernity would free him from the intellectual blackmail of being for or against the Enlightenment and its claims to express universal norms. In respect of the universality of those norms, the libertine Foucault sought to escape the restrictions or disapproval of the morally censorious Kant. This was difficult for Foucault, since in his lifetime his inherited major premise seemed self-evident. We must never forget that the Enlightenment is an event, or a set of events and complex historical processes, that is located at a certain point in the development of European societies, so that we are beings who are historically determined, to a certain extent, by the Enlightenment. That premise is challenged here. Before 1984, Foucault was attempting to escape from a historiography that the present book argues had been falsely constructed. He had not made good his escape. Even postmodernists had to assume the reality of the event or set of events and complex historical processes from the philosophical consequences of which they sought to emancipate themselves. But Foucault's confused locution here is evidence for his inability to resolve a historical problem, however able he was as a philosopher. The present book readdresses that question. Why are such concepts so important? Not because they necessarily identify realities. Concepts may exist independently of the reality or unreality of their reference, like phlogiston and ectoplasm. In either case, concepts arrange data and so seem to turn a mass of disordered material into evidence. They almost constrain their users to think in some ways about that material and almost prevent them from thinking in other ways. Once coined, concepts can be reified and thereby turned from attempted explanatory devices into things. As things, concepts largely conceal, and so nearly legitimate, the procedure whereby historians put words, and therefore meanings, into the mouths of people in the past, and by the same authority, into the mouths of people in the present. The consequences of such a procedure hardly need emphasis. Yet, although powerful, concepts have lifespans. In recent decades, historians traced the rise and fall of empires. More recently, they were preoccupied with what they saw as the rise and fall of social classes, or, more recently still, the rise and fall of identities. Today, some scholars are drawn to trace instead the rise and fall of explanatory concepts. In due course, they may even historicize concepts.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?